It's time for another episode of Spies, Lies, and Private Eyes. Here's your host, Terrence McCauley.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Spies, Lies, and Private Eyes, right here on the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. My guest today is Rick Mofina. He is a former journalist and is an award-winning author of several acclaimed thrillers. Someone Saw Something is his latest book from Mira. Rick, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Someone Saw Something?
Someone Saw Something. Well, it begins with a little boy being walked home from school in the Upper West Side in New York City. He's going through Central Park with his older sister. He's 6 years old. The family is a well-to-do power couple. The mother is a network journalist. Father builds skyscrapers in Manhattan. And when his older sister is distracted, I mean, they know New York City quite well. Central Park is practically their backyard. Mm-hmm. But when the older sister gets distracted on her phone, the little boy vanishes. And as detectives start to look deeply into the circumstances and look deeply into the family and all of their history and secrets, things begin to look a little murky. The mother had threats against her because of her position in network news. The father mm-hmm. is dealing with a nefarious group who are funding a super tall skyscraper in Manhattan. And the teenage daughter is dating an older young man who has connections to possibly a crime family in greater New York. So all of this comes wow. together while the clock is ticking.
Wow. Sounds like you've got an awful lot going on in this book, don't you?
Yeah, there's a lot going on.
Now, what made you want to set it in New York among such a power couple like this?
Oh, there were a number of factors, Terrence. There were a number of things that inspired me, and I make several trips to Manhattan for conferences and book business. And I'm not, intimate with Central Park, but it's quite familiar with it. And being a former journalist, I had a couple of colleagues who are actually still employed and in the business with some large news organizations. I won't name them, but they helped me
sure.
In conversations with some of the background of what was happening. Also, I think some of the industry itself, I'm talking about journalism, the industry itself is sort of under siege by a number of factors and in transition. That all came together. Conspiracy theories came together. Talking with the colleagues who are in the mix right now to cover campaigns and cover other things, what they'd gone through. They helped me with their insights to inject some reality into the fiction, or to make it ring true for them.
Right.
And Manhattan, to come back to your question, it just seemed like the most likely place for something like this, mm-hmm. for the story I was looking at. And I did have the cooperation of the NYPD, visited with them at the Central Park precinct.
Yep.
They instructed me on the step-by-steps of what happens when a child gets separated from their guardians. So that rings true in the opening movements. Also, being familiar and having the ability to draw on my relationships with some of my former colleagues, I was able to inject some reality into their life experiences to create the characters I created.
Right, right. Yeah, it's fascinating that you decided to set it here and tell the kind of story you did, because this one seems to be more of a standalone than some of your other works, right?
Exactly. This is a true standalone with a lot of layering in terms of you can read meaning and different layers into the story. It's a procedural, it's a clock is ticking thriller, but yeah, it's a standalone.
It's a standalone. Yeah. So why did you decide that this was the kind of story that you wanted to tell as a standalone rather than fold it into any of the other series or start a new series with these characters?
Well, I had just finished a series about a journalist, Ray Wyatt, which was a sort of a series of three short novels, which is doing quite well. So I was ready to do a standalone. And with the publisher, I've been doing standalones. The last several books have been standalone thrillers. So we've been following right. that model. The the story itself just resonated with all of the different elements that just hit hard. And I sort of felt an emotional former professional connection to it. I really like this story.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny how we all, those of us who write series, love our series characters. But yes. when we come down to it, the standalones have their own sort of charm for us, just like short stories and novellas do.
Exactly. For me anyway, you have to sort of be in the mood for something. There are times when I want to create a series, I think of a character and I think of a story arc. Other times you just want to hit one bam, like a big storm. Just this one's okay. And many times readers who do like the characters ask for more, but sometimes it's like you empty the till with this particular story and these characters, you don't really want to come back because I would think maybe I'm not up to bringing them back as strongly as possible, but you never know.
Right. Yeah. You always want to be open to what the audience wants, because ultimately we are entertainers, but we're also artists. So we have a vote too in what kind of art we create. Yeah. It definitely is like that. So, I mean, now you've written series and you have written standalones. Do you have a favorite of which type you like to write, or is it just wherever the muse takes you at that point?
It's true. Wherever inspiration takes me, I really have no preference. I mean, there are the, if you want to speak about the, technically about the books, there's the ease of a series knowing that, you know what the apartment looks like, you know what the house looks like where your character lives or the community, unless they're moving, so that you can fall back on that. With a new character, you don't have to worry so much about where they're going. It's just it's a one-off. So right. There are the pros and cons, if I even want to call them that. But I enjoy it all, actually. So I don't mind. I think when the inspiration strikes, and I have to admit, all the series I've done, because I've lost track of four or five series going, they've all been reporter protagonists, because that's the skin I'm comfortable in emotionally. I'm a little behind the times on the technology, and my friends who are still in the business remind me of that. And I said, well, I'll just turn my characters into old school types. I mean, you know, they started when there was no internet.
Right. And when a Rolodex really was a Rolodex on your desk. Yeah,
That's right. And it took maybe hours to find something out or days on an individual as opposed to seconds on their keyboard. So yeah, I have fun with that, but nevertheless, I really have no preference. I can go either way.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, that's the way I've spoken to several authors who've done both series and done standalones, and they feel the same way. It's basically whatever the story seems to be calling out for. And you can always kind of tell when an author shoehorns a different story into the existing canon of a series, if you read close enough.
Oh yeah, you can sometimes find the seeds, as it were. Yeah,
right, exactly. Yeah, it's in terms of your writing style, who would you say was somebody who influenced you to want to do this kind of writing in terms of crime writing? Because as a journalist, you've been exposed to an awful lot of different issues, a lot of different scenarios. I'm sure you could have done a romance had you wanted, or you could have done an adventure book or something, or sci-fi maybe. So what was it about crime, and what were your inspirations to start writing in the genre?
Well, it's a good question, actually. Personally, going way back, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. I went off to university to get a degree in journalism and to get a job, but I wanted the experience of a journalist to facilitate my creative fiction. I had always been writing as a kid, even before I went to university. So was really to go to university to find a profession that would help with the writing. And mm-hmm. Reading about other authors over decades, and a lot of them followed in the journalistic tradition. So I thought, I'm from a small town where nothing happens. I'll be a reporter, get a job, and experience life. But when I finished university, I liked supernatural stuff. Stephen King stuff was emerging. Exorcist, Rosemary's Baby stuff. And, I thought I'd try my hand at that. And I wasn't too sure. And then I was assigned to work night cops. And at that around that time, a news photographer and I were rushing off to something in the car, and he had a copy of The Poet in the front seat. And he said, "Have you ever heard of this guy?" And I said, "That no." He said, "You should read him." And then I was also reading Laura Lippman at the time and a few others. What was her name? Edna Buchanan was doing nonfiction out of Miami. Right. So I got thinking about my position as a night cop reporter, and I thought, well, I know this stuff. And I had admired the journalists turned crime fiction writers who got it bang on. And I sort of, you know, turned my nose up at people who thought they were injecting journalism into their crime stories and it was totally wrong. So I thought this is for me. I'll give it a shot. I've got access to the actual, to real crimes. I've got access to detectives. I've got the drama of a big city newsroom at a newspaper. Mm-hmm. So I sat down and plotted out my first novel. It took a while, and long story short, it got published, and I was comfortable with that genre. So that's how it all happened, even though I still think about supernatural stuff, but I never did really dwell on that too much. So.
Right, right. Yeah, it's amazing how the art seems to find us, if we have other plans.
Yeah, I like how you put that. That's true, yeah. Yeah, I think there was one night on the cop desk when I saw a dead body and I was talking to the inspector. I was the overnight shift, so it gets pretty quiet and you can get philosophical with these guys. And he knew I was sort of a greenhorn, and he sort of showed me things, told me things. We would chat, and it worked out all right. I spent a lot of time down at the – they even locked me up a few times for fun and processed me and all of that stuff. So you get to learn these things. And, you know, what was a stupid question that a reporter could ask? And I remember one time I was visiting some guys at the homicide unit, and I saw a textbook on the desk called Practical Homicide Investigation. And this was a real textbook that guys study. And the sergeant who was head of the unit, he said, "You should read that," just like that. At the time, you couldn't just get it anywhere. So my wife got it for me as a beautiful birthday gift. And I read that thing, read it cover to cover. Twice actually, and it helped me professionally and it helped me creatively. And I know a lot of people know about books now. There are several editions, but it was really good.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, it's interesting that you have to use the kind of tools that you have at your disposal in order to create your art. And you were able to do that. Plus, your practical experience as a night desk reporter gave you a unique perspective on the topic and the genre.
Yeah, it did. I mean, when it was slow at night back then, you know, the wire services, we always used to joke, was sort of like the first internet. And we could read stories from all over the world because we, you know, big newsroom subscribed to a lot of the wire services. And sometimes when it was quiet, I would just admire some of the excellent writing in some of the stories that were coming across, how things could be conveyed poetically. And I guess that's why I admired Conley. I admired Thomas Harris, especially right from.
I was going to bring him up.
Yeah, right from Black Sunday, right up through to the most recent book. I can see in my mind, and I would argue this with anybody, I can see the Associated Press style in his work, because it's generally three short sentences to a paragraph, tight, make every word count. And Harris took that to another level. And in my view, he followed that structure, but he turned it into dark poetry. You know, I don't know how long he takes with the draft, but I mean, when you read some of that stuff, it just, to me, it just conveys almost like a T.S. Eliot of journalism. And I really enjoyed that style. I admire it all the time. And I go back to his books and I think, how did he do that? Wow. You know.
Yeah, it was with an economy of words and an economy of explaining and describing the scenes that he wants, because he puts the terror in our own mind. He very rarely, especially in Silence of the Lambs and before that Red Dragon, he rarely got gory on the page. It was always in our mind where we were left to picture it.
Yes, and he really did ratchet up the tension almost with every sentence. I mean, some people did like it. They thought, I've heard the criticism, oh, it's overwritten, it's over-dramatized. Well, you know, it's all a matter of taste and preference, and I quite enjoyed it. Because I guess I knew the tradition he was coming from, because I know he did work at the Associated Press for a while coming up in New York, I believe. when he launched off on Black Sunday.
Right, right. Yeah, and he had the one sentence of his that sticks out in my mind, and I promise this isn't gory, everybody, but when he shows Starling a picture of Hannibal Lecter's latest victim, who was a nurse who was taking care of Lecter when he was in prison, and they took him to the hospital, and he says, in the text says, he showed Starling the picture of the nurse, and Crawford said they'd managed to save most of her tongue. And that's it. That's the only,
I know,
only description. And I was like, wow, hell, that was an awesome way of doing it.
That's the genius of it. That's the genius of it. Just just the poetry, just a couple of words. That's all you need. And yeah, so
yeah,
he'll always be high up in the pantheon for me. So
yes, I think he will too, especially in my pantheon. But it's interesting that you were talking about how journalism has changed over the years. And it seemed like when you started, it was part of that time when journalism, you wanted to get it right, but it was also a more contemplative time where you actually had the time to think about the story you were doing. You were on deadline, but over a series, especially if you covered the same beat over and over again, you were encouraged to get an understanding of what you were covering, as opposed to now with the advance of technology, it seems to be rip and read, get it out there first, and then we'll clean it up later on.
Yeah, I mean, I have to confess ignorance because I'm not really in the mix anymore, but from my understanding is that you're always on deadlines. I mean, to me, actually, the first breaking news stories come out of Instagram or Twitter. I mean, usually it's the people involved in the story. That's how much it changes. You might call them citizen reporters. And again, usually the first bits of information are confusing and wrong, and you always wait for a credible source to verify things. But it's usually the very first drop in the pond comes from a social media outlet, not a news outlet, usually an individual who just saw something, captured something, and it goes from there. That's one type of breaking news reporting, as opposed to, say, something investigative where someone has dug into something for months and months and then breaks a story. That still exists. But the technology and the demands have changed so much. And I think because everyone has the potential to be a reporter, things get challenged quite a bit. And, I guess I'll always defend the institution itself, because number one, you had to get it right. If you got it wrong, you ran what we call clarifications, corrections. You were at risk of being sued. Depending on the nature, you could even face charges. So there were guardrails and credibility. I mean, the Washington Post was disgraced with a fabricated story, gave the Pulitzer back, acknowledged the error. And other newspapers do the same. It happens from time to time. You don't see that with certain other types of organizations that just say whatever. But the technology has changed. The demands have changed. Maybe even the standards, to some measure, have changed. But that now that we're getting onto this, Terrence, that's what sort of brought me to Someone Saw Something. I wanted to bring some of that home, how things can get dangerously out of hand. And it was, the little realistic ones, the Pizzagate in Washington and some of the others.
Right.
It got me thinking, the wheels were turning. And I have to admit, conspiracies, if you will, can be fun. I mean, I'll confess, I've always believed in the Kennedy conspiracy. It had to be someone involved. It couldn't be. And I believed that for a long time, till I saw an incredible, convincing documentary that was scientific. And I thought, yeah, and there were I don't know what it was to date, 150 different confessions to involvement as opposed to only one truth. I don't know. But
right,
to believe in that, I'm not hurting anybody. I'm not changing anyone's life, or are there UFOs, or is there this or that?
Right.
Those types of things are fun. And my daughter and I and the kids, we mute, that's something just parlor room fun, as opposed to I'm going to take action now. And something that happened, I don't think it really did happen. And then to the point where you're hurting people, that's where it all converged for me for this story, to things taken to the extreme, which is what we do in crime fiction. I mean, we dramatize things and maybe over dramatize them, but there's underlying truths, I think.
Of course, yeah. I think crime fiction tends to falter when it loses sight of that, of the universal truths. And I think that it's a good medium for being able to ground people in an entertaining way that feeds their Jones for crime fiction, or their appetite for a good old kidnapping or a murder mystery.
Yeah, I think it also, and it also should, in doing so, whether we do it full bore intentionally or even just unintentionally, we're touching on to some social truths as well, and social issues as well, raising that. I mean, the scenes in the current book where I dramatize on how some news organizations decide they're going to present a story and then let people decide for themselves about the veracity of it. It's more of a sort of an entertainment rather than journalism, which, you know, that's all fun and games if you're not hurting anybody, but we'll see.
Oftentimes it does wind up hurting people, and the truth suffers most of all, unfortunately.
Yeah.
It really does. Now you, go ahead. Yeah.
No, go ahead.
I was going to ask you, I know that this one is a standalone, and I was wondering what else is on the docket for you in terms of your novel writing endeavors.
Well, as we speak, I'm coming to the finish line of the first draft of another standalone that'll be out next year.
Awesome.
I won't get into what it's about, but it's another standalone thriller, which I'm enjoying, and I'll be glad to get it done. And then that will complete my contract. We'll probably see about where we stand for the next contract. And if there is time, I would like to do. I'm a hybrid. I self-publish a lot of my own stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm going to take a shot at a novella that I tried years and years ago, and I started looking at the old notes and some of the old drafts, and I thought this might be the time to shake the dust off and finish that one, because it's sort of crying out to me. It's probably, you know, fairly short novel, but it would be very dark, crime fiction, almost evocative of a noirish movie. Because it's got some dark themes, and I thought, I think it's time to do that one, because the characters are crying out, their story elements that are coming to me, and I'm thinking, I got to get that one out of my system, because I'd love to get it out there. So I'm quite fortunate that I can self-publish these things. I mean, as long as I don't violate any contractual terms,
sure,
with the legacy publisher, it's worked out fine for me. I've had friends over the years who also told me that you do have to be careful when they have tried things like that. If they were a little off base, it can really bring the wrath of the publisher down if you're seen to be in violation of a contract by self-publishing something or going to another publisher. It gets very tricky, but that's another side of the business.
Right, exactly right. But it's one that people have to be mindful of, because if you are fortunate enough to have been traditionally published and you do want to go off on your own to publish something, it's important to know where the pitfalls are. And so that way you don't waste time tending to the paperwork, if you will, but you're spending your time getting your book the best it can be and bringing it to market.
That's right. And I'm very, very fortunate. I really have a good relationship with HarperCollins / Harlequin / Mira. That's a big conglomerate. But I've been with them for a number of years, and we're doing quite well. So I hope to stay with the team, and nothing but praise for them, because they really do a lot of hard work for you. So.
They do, yeah. I hear from their publicists a lot about a lot of their authors. So, yeah, they're doing all they can to set their people up for success. Now, if people want to follow what you're doing, what's the best way they could do it? Your website, your social media presence, stuff like that.
Yep. I mean, I'm not super big out there, but Instagram is probably the best right now, and the website, where I try to put up what I can when I can. My kids help me with that. I'm not very good at all of that. a little bit of Facebook, which sometimes gets a little murky and complicated. I've had, you know, messages that have been sort of hung up there that they're 4 or 5 months old and I see them for the first time. So I it's okay for posting stuff, but yeah, to come back to that, Terrence, social media is where I'm at, and you can always email me. It's always in the back of the book and how to reach me. So
fantastic. Well, I'm sure that the audience learned a lot from you today, and I know they're going to be definitely checking out your latest book and all of the series that you've done as well.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. It's just nice to talk your ear off.
Oh, that's fine. No, that's what we're here for, and that's what the audience loves. So thank you for taking the time to do it. We really appreciate it.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks, Ted.
Thank you. And thank you, everyone, for joining us for yet another edition of Spies, Lies, and Private Eyes right here on the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. We'll see you next time, everyone. Take care.
You have been listening to Spies, Lies, and Private Eyes with host Terrence McCauley on Authors on the Air Global Radio Network.